Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Wildfires, schools, and the LA Times. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Recent wildfires have burned hundreds of thousands of acres in Southern California, destroyed property, and killed five firefighters. Tonight we'll talk to a man who says it's going to get worse, and government policies are part of the problem. He's the former director of the National Parks. On Reporter's Notebook, Roy Romer, retiring superintendent of LA schools. Also tonight, the new editor of the LA Times says the paper is going to be sold. First, here's the news. We're only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Recent wildfires have devastated Southern California, and worse ones are on the way. Tonight we'll hear what government policies have to do with it. On Reporter's Notebook, Roy Romer reflects on the past and future of LA schools. First, this story, Jim O'Shea is the latest editor of the LA Times. Doesn't want to be viewed as a hatchet man. Like others before him, he's told the newsroom he'll try to avoid staff cuts if he thinks they'll damage the paper. But his wife is staying behind in Chicago because, quote, sometime after the first of the year, we are probably going to have new owners, close quote. Tim Rutten is a veteran editor and reporter who writes the Regarding Media column for the LA Times. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Warren.
How did it go down in the newsroom when they heard that word?
Well, I think it was a confirmation of something everybody knew anyway. And I think, if anything, it probably, enhanced people's feelings toward Jim O'Shea because he was being candid.
He's being candid, and he certainly was supportive of the paper and supportive of Dean Baquet, his immediate predecessor, who left because he didn't want to make cuts.
Well, that's right, and although every editor says they don't want to make cuts, and every editor says that they don't want to make cuts that damage the paper, the question is always where you think damage occurs.
Well, does he think that there might be cuts demanded before the sale of the paper?
I don't think he knows that. I would be surprised if he did. But I think that I'm a little unclear as to what would be gained by cutting further now. Usually you cut in anticipation of a sale because you want to expand the available universe of buyers by making the overhead lower. I don't really think that's a consideration here, but who knows?
What about the value of the stock when there is this uncertainty about cuts? And is it important that buyers, potential buyers, know that the paper really is for sale?
Well, I think at this point everybody does know it's for sale. I mean, Tribune has put itself as a whole up for sale. They're entertaining offers. I think that they made it clear that they're willing to a week or so ago that they're willing to entertain offers for the individual properties. So I think there's no doubt that the paper's for sale. As far as the value of the stock goes, well, I'm not qualified to give financial advice to anybody, or if I would, I wouldn't be working for a living.
It was my understanding that O'Shea had something to say about it. That's why I
Oh yeah, well, I think everybody worries about that. One of the things that's interesting about I think in some ways this is this is a bit of a digression, but you see the new economics of the workplace at work in Chicago's preoccupation with that stock price. One of the reasons people from the Tribune, meaning the Chicago Tribune, tend to be a lot more focused on the stock price than we do is that traditionally they haven't had a pension plan. They've just had a 401k, and that makes people there much more focused on the stock price than those of us who came along at the LA Times might have been, or any of the other Times mirror papers might have been when we had traditional, pension plans. So that's part of the new economics of the workplace. As far as the stock price goes, I think at this point, if I understand the logic of Wall Street correctly, Tribune has worked itself into a position where they have to sell or face an absolutely precipitous drop in the price of the stock, and that's something that probably would not be acceptable to the Chandler Family Trust, which, after all, at this point hold 20% or one-fifth of all the outstanding shares in Tribune.
And which it's a big family, and we learned today in the LA Times that they are divided as to what exactly ought to be done with this asset. But when you say that why cut now, it won't expand the universe of possible buyers, might not increase the value of the asset, was this good news then coming from the editor, and is it less likely, do you think, that cuts really will occur?
Yeah, I think it is good news. Whether or not cuts occur will, I suppose, depend on things we can't calculate now. I do think that if the Tribune company's executives are responsible for next year's budget for the LA Times, they will probably demand additional cuts. That's in the logic of the situation. It's the issue over which they've replaced the publisher and the editor of the newspaper.
What about the mood in the newsroom right now? Are others persuaded that this might, in fact, be good news? Is uncertainty making it difficult to cover the stories that need to be covered and edit the copy that comes flowing in?
No, I think, I don't think that so. I mean, I think that anybody who read the paper last week saw, pretty good coverage of the elections, and the papers every day have looked very good to me since. I think that, you need to keep in mind that people found out that Dean Baquet had been fired, just hours before they had to put out the election edition, and yet it came out and it was very good. I don't see any problem there. It just increases the degree of difficulty, and it's something you'd rather not deal with. But coming from television, the way that you do, you understand that kind of uncertainty, and you also understand that one of the things that separates the pros from people who sort of play at this is that you deal with it.
The new publisher has indicated that he wants to see changes, more emphasis on Los Angeles, things of that kind. Here's Jim O'Shea coming out from Chicago, another editor who doesn't really know the territory. Is there much possibility that there's going to be a significant change in the paper before it gets sold?
Oh, I think there'll be. I don't know that there's enough time to make those kinds of structural changes, because they would involve shifts of people and resources that really take time to do. The Los Angeles Times is a great big place that does a lot of very complicated things, and you don't alter its direction overnight. One of the things that is interesting about what's been proposed since David Hiller, the new publisher, arrived, a greater attention, for example, to Latino readers, English-speaking Latino readers, and to a lesser extent, Spanish-speaking ones, more regional coverage, more local coverage. The fact of the matter is that these were all things that the Los Angeles Times was doing when Tribune acquired Times Mirror. And the efforts to do all those things were dismantled under the administration of people installed here by Chicago. So it's an interesting kind of change in direction, and it's slightly perplexing to know how it's going to be guided by people who really will need some time to learn this area.
Contradictory is what you're saying.
I would say that's a fair assumption, yeah.
All right, we will see if there are more contradictions and what happens next at the LA Times, beginning to be one of the best stories in town. Tim Rutten, the regarding media columnist for the Times, as always, many thanks.
Always glad to be with you.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Five firefighters died last month in Riverside County's Esperanza Fire. The Day Fire near Ojai burned 600,000 acres and took a month to contain. Fires like that are going to get bigger, and not just because of global warming. Government policies are partly to blame. That's according to Roger Kennedy, director of the National Park Service for 4 years under President Bill Clinton. He's author of Wildfire and Americans, How to Save Lives, Property, and Your Tax Dollars. Roger Kennedy, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
How many fires did you have to fight, or did the people under you have to fight when you were head of the Park Service?
Oh, they add up, of course, into hundreds, in fact, into thousands. The question, of course, is not so much fire, but people in dangerous places. The problem of wildfire isn't wildfire. The problem is people exposed to danger. That's the point.
Tell us how government policies, to go back to the theme of your book, put people in danger.
Two things happen. Deliberate dispersion of the old industrial cities, lest they be targets for the Soviets during the Cold War, led to a whole panoply of devices, highway construction, insurance for mortgages promiscuously wherever the houses were built. And the desire was for nearly 40 years to disperse the older cities and send people into places where they would be less vulnerable to Soviet attack. What wasn't anticipated and wasn't considered was whether or not they'd be exposed to other kinds of dangers at the end of the dispersion process.
That's what
happened, of course. And because we didn't pay any attention to the places in which we insured the mortgages, to which we built the roads, to which we built the infrastructure and supplied the power, and since we didn't warn anybody where they were going, what's happened is that we have people unknowingly, essentially assured by the nation that it was going to take care of them wherever they settled, that, so to speak, the National Fire Department would take care of them, and it isn't true, it isn't fair, and it wasn't right.
Don't a lot of people go to these places because they desire to be away from the hustle and bustle of the city, the crime,
yep,
and all of that?
Yep.
Is it entirely government policy, or isn't
it's not
driven very much by what property owners want to do?
It's not entirely by government policy, though what happens is the accumulation, of course, of fire load resulting from government policy, which suppressed little cleansing fires and built up fire load, meaning tinder, essentially, for big fires. That was one government policy of 70 years standing that was a mistake. On top of that, the nation deliberately dispersed its population to places where people were unwarned of their dangers. It wasn't, of course, just fire-prone places. It's flood-prone places, too. If you want to know whether it's dangerous or not for you to build in a floodplain below a dike, nobody's going to tell you that. And, of course, we should be not only telling people the kinds of dangers they're accepting, but we also ought to meter out the kind of subsidies we issue as a nation at taxpayer expense. So those subsidies go to inducing and encouraging development and building in safe places, not unsafe places.
Why doesn't the insurance industry take care of this?
Aha. Favorite question, because, of course, the insurance business companies are not free to decide whether or not they're going to insure it, particularly in California, because the state of California has its own legislation which requires insurance companies to participate in pools of insurance in places they wouldn't otherwise insure. It is not true that the market sets the rates or sets the availability of insurance, particularly in California. That is rigged. It's popular to make sure that everybody gets insured, but, of course, the rest of us pick up the tab.
We're talking with Roger Kennedy, director of the National Park Service, for 4 years. It seems to me that this is not, then, so much a federal issue as it is a state and local issue. You're talking about zoning ordinances.
But the billions, is not trillions, in mortgage insurance, in highway construction, in direct developer assistance, and in income tax deductions for mortgages made wherever the mortgage is. That's all federal money. That's all federal taxpayer money. And it's immense. And, of course, the firefighting cost is also on the federal taxpayer, largely. The firefighting cost is borne by the feds, pretty much, when it's big.
So these are government policies, to go back to your book, Wildfire and Americans, How to Save Property and Save Lives, Property, and Your Tax Dollars, government policies that have to do with the way in which people are put in danger,
yes,
without really knowing that's going to happen. You,
yep,
also talk about the way in which fires are fought, and you're not happy about that either.
I surely am not. We send very, very brave young men and women, many of them drawn from other activities in the Forest Service and the Park Service in particular, to go fight fires to protect real estate development. Fighting fires to protect people is, of course, a good thing. But fighting fires and letting people know that whatever they choose to build, wherever they choose to build it, however unsafe it may be and however unsafe the neighborhood may be because there isn't sufficient fire protection in those neighborhoods, in those communities, that we're going to send somebody in to fight and possibly to die, that's wrong.
Well, when they get out there and they do that, they, I think, in many cases, think that they are saving individual people, particularly if they happen to live in the neighborhood where the fires are occurring. Are they adequately equipped?
No, they're not. They're not adequately, all of them adequately trained. They're not adequately equipped, particularly the aircraft that conspicuously flies close to the flames is frequently obsolete. It wouldn't be sent into combat. It's not the kind of aircraft and tankers and other spotters that we would let the military willingly have. No, we are going at this on the cheap, and we are going at it after the fact. What we need to do is to slow down the pace of the land rush into danger, which we are subsidizing, and we need to have year-round, full-time, fully trained fire load diminution. We need to get rid of that accumulated fire load that has been built up by small fire suppression, and we need to have professionals do it year-round and get very adequately paid for it.
So, in other words, during fire season, they would fight fires. When the fire season isn't, it's the same thing that local firefighters do, I guess, in cities.
That's right.
When there's not a fire season or not a fire going on, then they're working on on the future.
That's absolutely right. We do need to go around each of the communities that are now in place and do a couple of very important and simple things. First, we need to reduce the rate at which fires can creep along the ground and then swoop up into crown fires by getting rid of the tinder. But in every community, there must be ordinances which see to it that if your neighbor doesn't clean up the fire-prone circumstances in their yard, they are recognized as a danger to the rest of the community and penalized for it. That's true in many states. It ought to be true everywhere.
All right. One further question. You were in the Park Service. That's under the Interior Department. The Forest Service is under the Department of Agriculture. The Inspector General of that department is looking into what they call the human aspect of what happened when the five firefighters were killed in the Esperanza fire, with an eye to possible disciplinary or even criminal action.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
No. In my view, that's scapegoating. The problem here is a generic one. The problem here is a process and system which puts people in dangerous places. The problem isn't malfeasance. The problem is certainly not corruption. This process of going to look for somebody who is responsible for it, for some arsonist or some sinister person that didn't do it right, that's the way you escape a generic, serious, systematic effort to fix this crazy, murderous situation.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, sir.
Roger Kennedy, former director of the National Park Service, author of Wildfire and Americans, How to Save Lives, Property, and Your Tax Dollars. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're on only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Roy Romer was governor of Colorado and chair of the National Democratic Committee before he became the superintendent of L.A. schools. Today, he appeared before the school board for the last time and made way for his successor, former Admiral David Brewer. Governor, welcome as always.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show.
Well, how do you feel?
Well, I feel good. I feel like I've finished 6 years of a job and I need to move on to another one.
What are you going to do next?
I'm open. I'm going to take some time and to look. It'll be in the field of education, but it'll have a number of possibilities, but I'm still looking.
As governor, as committee chair, as superintendent, you have taken a lot of abuse from time to time. Which of those jobs was the most challenging and the most difficult?
Oh, I think the last one was the most difficult and the most challenging. And, hey, you know, abuse, criticism, it just comes with the territory. But this job was very large. I mean, you got a lot of employees, 80,000, you know, a lot of kids, 700,000, and there's a lot of politics in L.A. But particularly, they had neglected it for 30 years. You know, there We're way behind on building buildings and way behind on teaching kids how to read and write and do math.
You're doing a lot of building, and there will be more building to come as a result of the things that you have put in place. Is that your biggest achievement?
I think the biggest achievement is the change in academic performance, the instruction and the scores. The buildings are very important, and that'll be what everybody will remember the longest. But I think the real achievement is that we've got this place turned around. We have gained in the last 6 years at a rate of increase about 150% of the average school in the state. Did that for 6 years. That's good work. We got a lot more to do.
Why is it, if those kinds of gains have been made, and they are there on paper for anybody to see, that there is such a public perception that there has been no change, that in fact the schools are failing terribly? We know, of course, that the current mayor of Los Angeles campaigned for office on that presumption.
Well, look, there are certain items you can pick out and make a great deal of noise about. One is dropouts. Dropout is a really serious problem. We're improving it, but, you know, look, even though we've gained a great deal, a public institution like a large school district is subject to a lot of criticism. You can criticize us for bathrooms. You can criticize us for many things. But we have cured a lot of these things. It's just, it's hard to communicate with a community as large as L.A., particularly when you get people that want to be frank about it, make political points. It's pretty easy to do it with taking single, isolated facts and taking them out of context.
You lost that last battle. The mayor's legislation did pass, although it's nothing like what he originally proposed. Do you think that it will make things better or worse for your successor, Admiral Brewer?
Well, I don't think it'll make it better. But look, that's an argument I'm done with. I'm past. We've already decided that, and so we'll go forward. The courts need to clarify it. But I just feel that no matter whether we have that law or whether we don't have that law, we're still going to have a lot of progress in this district.
When you have the various stakeholders, as they're called, some of the major ones are the teachers' union and, of course, the elected board itself. Tell us about how difficult it is to deal with those two institutions.
Well, look, a board is seven members, and it is always challenging because you've got seven different points of view. I respect these people. They're very good people. They're very smart. They're very dedicated. They just have differing opinions. The union, again, I think is intending to do the right thing, except I think their agendas often are not for children but for the adult members of their union. And I think that we need to constantly work together with the union, with all unions, and say, look, our real business here is to improve instruction. Sometimes you'll get adult agendas. Let's just take supervision of kids during a lunch hour. You know, teachers don't want to do it. We need help doing it, and that's a kind of a thing we continue to negotiate.
You mentioned at the outset 80,000 employees, 700,000 kids in the system. Should the district be broken up?
You can debate this. I think it's good that we have it as one district right now because we're doing the building. We're using the strength financially of a very large district to put buildings in a portion of town where it's very poor. Now, we couldn't do that if we didn't have a big district. So right now, the size of the district helps. 5-10 years from now, you may want to find a different way to organize it.
What advice are you giving to, or have you given to, Admiral Brewer, and are you going to be available to give further advice as he experiences the kinds of problems that you've already dealt with?
He and I have an understanding. He can call me anytime. But, you know, he's a very experienced administrator. I just need to get out of his way and let him be superintendent. That's what I intend to do. Now, I will be around being helpful when they come across something they need to have information or history about. I'll be glad to help. But it is important when you leave a job to get out of the way and let the next person you go do it and do it his way.
He is an experienced administrator. You were an experienced administrator. Neither of you, though, had direct experience with education. Has that been a problem, do you think?
Look, you have to learn it. I had to learn it every day for 6 years, and I'm still learning. It would be better if you had that experience, but there are times that you bring a freshness to the plate that is helpful to me from the outside. Now, look, you can get good superintendents from inside districts or from outside, either way. But let's make no bones about it. You come in from the outside, you got to learn, you got to learn hard.
What advice would you have for the people most concerned about the district, other than the kids, and that's the parents?
Well, my advice is stay the course. We have something going here that's going to really change all of Los Angeles. One, stay the course on this building program. We need to finish that, and we will. Secondly, stay the course on the curriculum that we're using. We have very good curriculum in elementary school. We need to develop better curriculum in middle and high school. But to parents, don't go finding the solution of the month or the solution of the year. Let's stay the course and improve what we got, but don't throw it away.
You going to stay in Los Angeles?
No, I will be. My home is in Denver, and I will go back to Denver in about 30 days. And I will be working out of that location, but I'll probably be working nationally.
Roy Romer, as always, many, many thanks.
Thank you.
Which Way LA, produced tonight by Carolyn Radziner and Christian Bordahl, technical director Phoebe Zimmerman. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.